Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Near Abroad, Putin, the West, and the Contest Over Ukraine and the Caucasus, by Gerard Toll, narrated by Christopher Duyard. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you will hear references to figures and tables present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Note on place names. Geography literally means earth writing. Place naming practices are part of how people write political geographies and live them. Names are often chosen to signify ownership of a territory or place, symbolically marking the political and cultural dominance of one group and one geopolitical relationship over others. In Ireland, naming a town Kingstown or Dunlira, Londonderry or Derry, conveys power and identity. The lands of the former Soviet Union have similar post-colonial contentious dynamics over place names. Multiple claims and languages are at play, as are abundant historical legacies and memories. In most Union republics, Russian was the dominant language, and the Russian administrative name for places tended to predominate locally and internationally. Since the Soviet collapse, the newly independent states have made varying efforts to nationalize place names, renaming towns, streets, and other places to privilege new nation-state heroes and dates while removing Soviet symbols. The place names in this book are, for the most part, simplified English language transliterations of official state language names. Thus, the names of oblasts and other locations in Ukraine are from Ukrainian, not Russian. I use Kyiv instead of Kiev, Donbass instead of Donbass, Kharkiv instead of Kharkov. Because language privileging, place naming, and territorial ownership are part of the contentious geopolitics examined in this book, I often provide competing names and forms of knowing places in the text. Thus, I use the Russian names Odessa, Kharkov, and Nikolaev when appropriate and when used by the speaker. Though Donetsk has a different spelling and pronunciation in Ukrainian and Russian, its common English transliteration misses this. Not so for Luhansk/Lugansk. I use transliteration from Ukrainian to name the oblast, but from Russian to name the Lugansk People's Republic, as this is its official name. Those with zero-sum mentalities will inevitably find problems with this, but part of the pedagogic value of the strategy adopted in this book is to foreground place contestation and the life world that is part of it, in context. The situation in the breakaway regions of Georgia is particularly complicated because one has trilingual geopolitical dynamics, titular nations, Abkhaz and Ossetians, a nationalizing state, Georgia, and a former imperial center that is now a privileged geopolitical player, Russia. This is to say nothing of non-titular minorities like the Armenians in Abkhazia. The politics of naming in South Ossetia begins with the existential question of whether that name is even recognized and acknowledged. The Georgian government abolished this region and name in December 1990. In Georgia, the north-central region of the country is named Shida Kartli, literally Inner Kartli. The area around the capital of South Ossetia is called Samochablo, literally, fief of the Machabeli clan. The names are ownership claims that locate the area within Georgian nation space imagining. Because South Ossetia nevertheless endured as a geopolitical fact on the ground, the Georgian government began to refer to it euphemistically as the Skinvali region. The name was a diminishing gesture in the face of the unilateral proclamation by those in power there that it was the Republic of South Ossetia. The practice I follow here in naming the two regional centers, capitals, of the breakaway territories in Georgia is to use both names, so as to signify the contested nature of these places, without privileging either. Thus, the Ossetian name, Skinval, and Georgian, Skinvali, is rendered Skinval or Skinvali. The same applies to Sokhum or Sokhumi, the administrative center of Abkhazia. As far as Georgians and most all of the international community are concerned, South Ossetia and Abkhazia are Georgian territory. To the de facto regimes in these areas, however, Georgia begins at the de facto boundary lines Russia has helped them establish in the region. I follow the convention of using the terms uncontested Georgia and Georgia proper to refer to Georgian territory beyond the boundary lines of the de facto states. I recognize that these terms are objectionable to Georgia, but they have the virtue of recognizing the material realities on the ground that persist in the face of imagined, seamless maps of territorial integrity. The Georgian government controlled enclave settlements within South Ossetia and Abkhazia until August 2008. The rule I adopt is to respect the place names that the majority of local residents use, with the alternative form in brackets. Thus, I use the name Tamarasheni, literally, built by Tamar, a famous queen in the Georgian pantheon, for the first Georgian settlement immediately to the north of the town limits of Skinval or Skinvali, instead of the Ossetian name Tamares. In the late Soviet census of 1989, this settlement had both Ossetian and Georgian families, some intermarried. As a consequence of the violence of 1990 to 1992, Skinval or Skinvali became predominantly Ossetian, and the settlements to its north overwhelmingly monoethnic Georgian communities. In saying this, however, we are summarizing a condition brought about by violence that forced people into either-or ethnic categories that may not reflect their kinship histories or actual beliefs and lived identities. I use the place name Akhilgori for the largely ethnic Georgian town to the southeast that was under Georgian government control until August 2008. In Soviet times, it was known as Leningori. The de facto Republic of South Ossetia authorities privileged the Ossetian variant of this Soviet name, Leningor. Other Soviet names endure in South Ossetia. Skinval or Skinvali today has both a Lenin Avenue and a Stalin Avenue, the latter figure an Ossetian folk hero, as he is also for some Georgians. Another Soviet name that endures is Rocky Tunnel, which is the Georgian form of the ethnic Ossetian village of Ruk on the southern slope of the Caucasus where it derives its name. I stick with the familiar Rocky and not the Ossetian name. I use the Ossetian name Styrgufta for the predominantly Ossetian settlement north of the Georgian enclave on the Trans-Caucasian Highway, Trans-Cam. I also give the Georgian name, which is Didigupta. The strategic bridge outside the town is known as the Gufta Bridge in Ossetian and Gupta in Georgian. The central river in South Ossetia is Styr Lyakva in Ossetian, Didi Lyakvi in Georgian, and Bolshoi Lyakvi in Russian. I use the translation Greater Lyakvi River and reserve Didi Lyakvi Valley specifically for the Georgian enclave north of Skinval or Skinvali, as this helps signify its ethnic Georgian character. Its destruction was a concerted effort to erase that cultural identity. Campaigns of purification and erasure by the victorious, unfortunately, are all too common in the wake of episodes of ethnicized and geopoliticized violence. In 2015, Ukraine's parliament launched a decommunization process that sought to erase Soviet names and symbols across Ukrainian territory. Thousands of Lenin statues have been toppled in Ukraine since its independence. A new wave started with the Euromaidan protests and continues, now legitimized by decommunization laws. Certain place names, like Dnipropetrovsk, now Dnipro, came too late to update maps in this work. Hundreds of place names were mandated for change in Crimea also, with a few replacement names recognizing the heritage of the Crimean Tatar, heretofore ignored by Kyiv. A move by U.S. technology giant Google to implement these changes sparked outrage in Moscow and Crimea. One Russian lawmaker charged the U.S. company, co-founded by a Russian immigrant, with topological cretinism. Place naming controversies and asterisks on maps indicating disputed territorial status are expressions of a place remaking geopolitical contest that unfortunately looks likely to continue for some time. Geographies are inevitably political, but they need not be about singular domination and control. They can be thought and lived differently. Introduction. Near Abroads. On my third evening in Russia, the world changed. I was in Stavropol, a city founded by Prince Grigory Potemkin at the time of the American Revolution, as one of 10 fortresses to defend the borders of the expanding Russian Empire. To the south were the Caucasus, formidable mountains and myriad peoples. Stavropol grew as an administrative center of Tsarist and later Soviet power. It briefly fell to the Wehrmacht in 1942 as the invading army drove unsuccessfully toward the oil fields of Baku. Later, a popular young party secretary from the area got noticed in Moscow, joined the Politburo, and in 1985 became general secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Mikhail Gorbachev's reforms would inadvertently lead to a geopolitical earthquake, the end of the Cold War in Europe, and the unthinkable, the collapse of the communist empire built by Lenin and Stalin. That evening, the provost of Stavropol State University toasted the health of the international academics attending the conference starting the next morning. Many other benevolent toasts were exchanged, and a singularly somber one. A researcher with the Memorial Human Rights Center reminded us that a war raged nearby in Chechnya, an inner abroad of Russia. Here, Russia's new president had approved the indiscriminate shelling of a Russian city and a dirty war against citizens redefined as terrorists. Returning to our hotel that evening in a bus under armed guard, a Croatian friend and I were chatting when told to turn on the television. Russian television was broadcasting footage of airplanes crashing into skyscrapers in lower Manhattan on what seemed like a continuous loop. The full magnitude of what had happened was only apparent the next day. Like many, the Twin Towers were entwined with personal memories. First, seeing them in rural Ireland on a pennant my uncle brought back from his vacation to New York, and later, visiting the observation deck with my parents and friends. Furthermore, the attack on the Pentagon was only 2 miles from my home, a few more from where I worked, and all too close to some former students who worked in the building. The entangled experience of proximity and distance only deepened when a speaker began the conference by declaring that now the United States would understand what Russia had been fighting for years. Chechnya is everywhere, he warned. Russia and the United States, in his opinion, needed to form an alliance of civilized powers against international Islamic terrorism. President Putin had said as much in his initial statement on the September 11th attacks. They went beyond national borders. They were a brazen challenge to the whole of humanity, at least to civilized humanity. The international community needed to pool its efforts in the struggle against terrorism, the plague of the 21st century. In the weeks that followed, Russia offered the United States intelligence cooperation, use of Russian airspace, and no objections to it taking over former Soviet military bases in Central Asia to prosecute a war against the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. Such cooperation, controversial within Russia at the time, would not last. Within a matter of months, disenchantment at the unilateralism of the Bush administration took hold. It only deepened as the United States legitimized preemptive war and then invaded Iraq on false pretenses and overthrew the country's long-standing regime. In August 2008, Russia went to war with Georgia, a country that had sent troops to support U.S. military efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. In late February 2014, Russian troops seized Crimea, while pro-Russian activists destabilized Ukraine's east in response to what President Putin portrayed as a Western-sponsored fascist coup in Kyiv, Kiev in Russian. What began as a geopolitics of solidarity and unity in September 2001 devolved over the course of more than a decade into a geopolitics of mutual antagonism and paranoia. This book examines the making of the geopolitical struggle between Russia and the United States over Georgia and Ukraine, two important Soviet successor states on the western and southern borders of the core successor state, the Russian Federation. The English phrase, near abroad, first emerged in 1992 as a consensus translation of the Russian phrase, Blizhnye Zarubezhye, literally, near beyond border. That phrase was a popular geopolitical label Russian politicians, in the wake of the Soviet Union's sudden dissolution, gave to the former Soviet republics that were now independent sovereign countries in their own right. The phrase acknowledged difference, yet also enduring proximity. Russia's new borderland states were familiar parts of the same country for decades, and for most places, lands within the Russian Empire before then. It was difficult for many Russians to let go of memories of these places as parts of their country, just as it was difficult for some beyond Russia to reconcile themselves to living in a separate new country. Confusion and mixed emotions were common. Many in the West heard in the phrase, near abroad, reluctance on the part of Russia to acknowledge the full sovereignty of the new post-Soviet states. Near abroad, they argued, was a new term for an old desire on the part of Russia to have a sphere of influence in the lands next to its borders. But near abroad was not one essential thing. It simultaneously named a new arrangement of sovereignty and an old familiarity, a long-standing spatial entanglement, and a range of geopolitical emotions. The other successor states of the Soviet Union had their own near abroads, countries they looked to with aspirations and hopes. The Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania looked to Scandinavia. The new countries in Central Asia and the Caucasus looked to Turkey and later China, most with ambitions to re-establish historic linkages and acquire contemporary investment and support. Armenians looked to their successful diaspora in Europe and North America, as did some Ukrainians. Those in Ukrainian Galicia looked toward neighboring Poland, with whom they had a contentious history. Georgia looked to Turkey, but also to the United States, where, after fragmentation and civil war, its well-known leader, Eduard Shevardnadze, was remarkably successful in attracting financial support for his beleaguered country. Between 1992 and 2001, the United States gave over $1 billion in financial assistance to Georgia, making it among the largest per capita recipients of U.S. aid worldwide. The United States also made it possible for some young Georgians to study in America. One of these students was Mikhail Saakashvili, who gained admirers in Washington and returned to Georgia with an ambition to transform his country into an America in the Caucasus. Though thousands of miles away, Georgia under Saakashvili adopted the United States as its near abroad, and a relationship of fealty and moral debt, enabled by globalization and the global war on terror, blossomed. Married to a Ukrainian-American who had worked in the U.S. State Department and Reagan White House, the leader of Ukraine's Orange Revolution, Viktor Yushchenko, also looked to Washington and Brussels for financial aid and geopolitical support. Both leaders cooperated to create a new interstate organization, the Community of Democratic Choice, as a vehicle for moving their states beyond Russia's orbit and into aspirational alignment with the European Union and the North American Treaty Organization, NATO. Geographically concentrated minority groups within Ukraine and Georgia did not share this geopolitical ambition. Indeed, before it was even expressed, some started contesting the prospect of the then Soviet republics acquiring greater power. In July 1990, a declaration of sovereignty by Soviet Ukraine's parliament heightened concerns among ethnic Russian Ukrainians in Crimea and elsewhere. In Odessa, a local professor formed a group called the Democratic Union of Novorossiya, New Russia. As Soviet Georgia proclaimed a return to the constitution of the pre-Soviet Democratic Republic of Georgia, mobilized ethno-political factions in Abkhazia and South Ossetia sought to secede. In this, they were following examples set by Armenians in the Nagorno-Karabakh oblast within Azerbaijan, and Soviet factory bosses and their Russophone workers in Transnistria, a region of Soviet Moldova. From regional rebellions in Azerbaijan, Georgia, and Moldova, those attempted in Ukraine were unsuccessful, came forth a new and surprisingly enduring geopolitical space, the post-Soviet de facto state. For these unrecognized polities, ethnic kin communities in nominally separate neighboring states and symbols of the Soviet Union were near and not abroad. For most Americans, the geopolitical dramas of post-Soviet space unfolded in faraway places of which they knew little. But the United States had its own domestic entanglements with post-Cold War Europe and post-Soviet space that were to prove significant. Ethnic communities from these lands cared about anchoring them in the West, and they lobbied successfully for the extension of NATO membership to Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. Both an imagined transnational community, a Judeo-Christian West, and personalized affective ties mattered in making this possible. Prominent European Americans, like Zbigniew Brzezinski, born in Warsaw in 1928, national security advisor to President Jimmy Carter, and Madeleine Albright, born in Prague in 1937, the United States' first female Secretary of State, were powerful advocates. George W. Bush's White House helped extend NATO farther east in March 2004, incorporating not only former Warsaw Pact territories, Bulgaria, Romania, and Slovakia, but also the Baltic states, remembered in Cold War America as captive nations, forcefully incorporated by the Soviet Union in 1940 and again in 1945. Ukraine and Georgia, founding territories of the Soviet Union, did not have powerful ethnic lobbies in the United States, but they did have friends in high places, and people interested in spreading freedom and democracy to the very borders of Russia. In Senators John McCain, Joe Lieberman, Lindsey Graham, Joe Biden, Carl Levin, and their like, men who came of age at the height of the Cold War, they had influential advocates. When Mikhail Gorbachev first spoke of a common European home in 1987, the administration of George H.W. Bush, which took office 2 years later in 1989, countered with the slogan, "A Europe whole and free." Both notions were deliberately vague, but Bush's catchphrase expressed what the NATO alliance states wanted. The phrase rearticulated in positive terms a long-standing Cold War aspiration to roll back the Soviet Empire on the European continent. Europe was a continent of captive nations awaiting liberation from a repressive imperial machine headquartered in the Kremlin. The end of the Cold War in Europe and the Soviet Union's subsequent collapse seemed to fully affirm this vision. Furthermore, the violent dissolution of Yugoslavia provided NATO with the opportunity to present itself as an indispensable security organization for advancing a Europe whole and free. There was considerable ambivalence about the place of Russia in this geopolitical vision. On the one hand, Russia was the historic enemy, the non-West, the main reason its former client states sought the protection of NATO membership. On the other hand, as Gorbachev's vision underscored, Russia was a European state, and furthermore, it was culturally, geographically, and civilizationally part of the West. NATO's policy of containment was widely credited with winning the Cold War. Its architect, George Kennan, had no ambivalence about NATO expansionism, describing it as a strategic blunder of potentially epic proportions. Enlargement, NATO's term of choice for expansion, went ahead nevertheless. Aspirant state leaders wanted it, While President Bill Clinton was keen to demonstrate the United States' indispensable leadership and to reap potential domestic political advantages, Russia was presented with a fait accompli to which it would have to adjust. Robert Hunter, the Clinton administration's ambassador to NATO, 1993 to 1998, oversaw the first round of NATO expansionism, but subsequently became skeptical of further expansionism. In a new 1999 strategic concept document, NATO presented itself as one of the indispensable foundations for a stable Euro-Atlantic security environment, based on the growth of democratic institutions and commitment to the peaceful resolution of disputes, in which no country would be able to intimidate or coerce any other through the threat or use of force. Its open door toward new members said nothing about geostrategic location. The prevailing geopolitical descriptions were either simply Europe or the Euro-Atlantic area, the latter specified as the territory of the participating states of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE, a group that now comprises over 50 states stretching across three continents. In ignoring geography, foregrounding democratic values, and expanding eastward toward Russia's borders, NATO looked like it was realizing the Cold War dream of a rollback. Certainly, many of its biggest supporters in the U.S. Congress saw it that way. Proponents spoke of a blue blob of democracy enlarging now that the red blob of totalitarianism had disappeared. Enduring imaginary collectives like the free world and the West became commonplace phrases like Europeanizing, joining the West, completing Europe, and extending the borders of freedom, all revealed the implicit geopolitical teleology at work. So also did a subtle divergence in the meaning of Euro-Atlantic, from simply naming a three-continent space of plural political systems, to naming also the aspirational space being created by NATO and European Union integration efforts. Russia and Central Asia were part of the first, but not the second. Many prominent officials from NATO's new member countries, famously dubbed New Europe by Donald Rumsfeld in 2003, amplified the idea of liberation, in the process touting their past victimhood and framing contemporary tensions with Russia as a civilizational struggle. They made common cause with the Bush administration's democracy promotion efforts, which became known as the Freedom Agenda by 2004. In 2008, they strongly supported the efforts of the Bush administration to grant a NATO membership action plan, ironically, for a policy ostensibly indifferent to location, abbreviated as MAP, to Ukraine and Georgia. The Bucharest Declaration of April 2008 is central to this book. Though not approving a membership action plan to Georgia and Ukraine, the North Atlantic Council nevertheless declared, "We agreed today that these countries will become members of NATO." It was an extraordinary pronouncement in many ways. First, it was a declaration of intent to expand NATO into territories that were intimately entwined with Russian and Soviet history, identity, and territory. This is not simply a matter of noting that Crimea, home of the extant Russian Black Sea Fleet, was formerly part of Russia until 1954. No country that was part of the original Soviet Union, whose territorial boundaries were drawn by Bolsheviks from Tsarist spatial legacies, had ever joined the West, not to mention the U.S.-led Cold War transatlantic alliance arrayed against the Soviet Union for decades. Second, NATO sought to incorporate these states despite the Russian government communicating that its expansion there crossed a red line as far as its national security was concerned. Third, it sought to incorporate these two states despite the fact that they both had long-standing internal divisions over NATO membership and significant ethno-territorial polarization that was inevitably going to be exacerbated by the move. The Bucharest Declaration was the moment the near-abroads of NATO and Russia clashed head-on. Indeed, the year 2008 was a moment of significant rupture in the post-Cold War security order in Europe. Kosovo unilaterally declared itself independent from...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?